You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm a little tired. I can use a cup of coffee.
we were just talking about that, how nice it would have been to have some caffeine right about now.
Apropos of this evening's topic, we're talking about stimulants.
America on speed, or various versions of speed.
What is a stimulant? Well, as a matter of fact, it's...
Do you know, John?
It's what a is drug, a stimulant? It's any drug that... one that stimulates the central nervous system, inducing alertness, elevated mood, wakefulness, increased speech and motor activity, and decreased appetite. Remember in the old days that, you know, everybody would take diet pills, quote unquote. A lot of musicians from my world used to do that. If you had a lot of gigs, you'd be up late at night, you would take diet pills.
Right.
Or the nasal things that you would clear out your nasals.
We actually did a research project on that in high school with rats.
Oh, really?
And it was like trying to figure out if they got more exercise because the diet pills were actually amphetamines, or if it was because they, you know, just their metabolism sped up. I don't remember what the results were. I don't know if the rats made it for more than a week or two.
So there's different kinds of stimulants. We have a list here.
Yeah, and people have talked, you know, people have heard of a lot of these, but amphetamines, ephedrine, MDMA, which is also known as ecstasy, and all those.
Or Molly.
Molly. Methamphetamines, also known as meth. Nicotine is a stimulant.
Yes.
Pseudoephedrine, which comes in Sudafed, which is also an ingredient of meth.
Right.
And cocaine. Those are some of the stimulants.
Those are some, but the number one, drum roll please, the number one stimulant used in America is our friend caffeine.
Yeah, it's funny. People keep describing it as another kind of white powder, which it is, but not how we ingest it.
So our guest tonight is Murray Carpenter, author of the new book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. There's some alliteration. His new book reveals the little-known truth about this addictive, largely unregulated drug found in coffee, energy drinks, teas, colas, chocolate. Wait.
Chocolate.
I'm outraged. And even pain relievers.
And we're going to learn why it has such a powerful effect on everything from boosting our mood, improving athletic performance, and I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
As well as how and why brands such as Coca-Cola, et cetera, have managed to not get it regulated or even labeled. And we learn, you know, how it affects the body and how it works in all a manner of a very short amount of time.
And later in the show, we'll be talking about other stimulants. We'll be joined by Dr. Himal Mitra. He's a staff psychiatrist at the Brookline Center and at our own Right Turn, and he has a private practice as well. We'll broaden the discussion to include, you know, ADHD medication and some of the effects they have on the body. There's some new numbers out about ADHD medication prescriptions, all of which are stimulants. And so we're going to talk about that later in the program. But right now, we'd like to welcome Murray Carpenter to Right Turn Radio. Welcome, Mr. Carpenter.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's an interesting show, and I'm glad to be part of it.
Well, we've been talking about this for a while because we at Right Turn are right down the street from a coffee shop that's very well known, but we're not going to advertise it. And we've been always talking about how there are all these kids waiting in line in front of us every day. You know, we get in line and there's like a bunch of, you know, third graders in front of us.
Yes.
At the end of school day. And it just kind of, we've always talked about caffeine as a risky thing. So can you tell us a little about how does caffeine work in the body?
Well, its primary mechanism is to block a neurotransmitter called adenosine that basically... I guess in layperson's terms, it would tell the body we're tired, and caffeine has the ability to looks enough like adenosine that it's able to sit in the receptors,
mm-hmm.
where the adenosine should be sitting, and just, elbow the adenosine away. And when we're fully caffeinated, as much as 50% of our adenosine receptors are going to be occupied by caffeine.
Fully caffeinated?
Well, optimally caffeinated. I would say when for those of us who consume coffee regularly, you know, when you've had whatever it is that you like, you know, two cups in the morning, then, yeah, typically you're going to be blocking about half of your adenosine receptors.
So how long do the effects of caffeine last? If I have my sacred cup of coffee when I wake up in the morning, how long can I expect the noticeable effects of caffeine to last, Murray?
Well, okay, the noticeable effects, not too terribly long. Typically, 4 or 5 hours would be the half-life, and it's going to vary person to person because we all have a different, we all process caffeine differently. But interestingly, some sleep researchers have found that even, a couple of cups of coffee in the morning can affect the later stages of sleep, the stage three sleep, in the wee hours of the following morning. So it's not like you're going to have a couple of cups of coffee in the morning and then be, tossing in bed with your heart thumping the way you might if you had coffee after dinner. But it can have subtle effects, as much as 18 hours later on your sleep.
Go ahead.
Well, I was wondering, what is the action besides, blocking that the neurotransmitter? What is the action on the brain? Why do I feel a little sharper? Why do I feel a little more alert? What's going on in my brain?
It's basically stimulating the central nervous system and just giving you, this slightly, this slight stimulant boost that you were talking about that we can expect from stimulants. So, this sense of optimism, acuity, all of these good feelings that we associate with caffeine are due both to the blocking adenosine and stimulating the CNS.
Well, it's interesting because when you talk about this, it just sounds wonderful and that there's no, side effects. But, I mean, we're all addicted to this, right?
Right. And again, I think you all know and your listeners know better than anyone that this term itself is fraught and it's heavily stigmatized, et cetera.
Yes.
And when throughout the book, I use the term addiction and addictive, to talk about the behavior and the substance, because it does mimic the patterns of an addictive drug, which is to say people crave it, use it daily, develop some tolerance to it, and when on ceasing use abruptly, even a small amount of caffeine, mm-hmm. we have a predictable sort of suite of withdrawal symptoms, with the headache being the most characteristic one.
Right, and we all acknowledge at work that we're addicted to it.
Yeah,
and but we're also not feeling like we abuse it. And I think that might be the difference. I mean, we have plenty of people who are in early recovery who have like 7 of those,
the monster drinks,
the really caffeinated, and they're in a little trouble with it.
And
but
they come to us and they say, "I don't know why, but I'm anxious all the time,
and
I'm not
sleeping."
Yeah, no, and you chuckle there, but it really is funny because of course for most of us we handle caffeine well, and again it's in a different category than any of the other drugs of addiction to begin with because most Americans are using it daily, and most of us would meet we would qualify it to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, anxiety and sleeplessness, I think they do sort of get short shrift and that even people who are using caffeine moderately can experience anxiety and sleeplessness that they do not associate with their caffeine use. Now, again, not everybody.
No, but that's true. And it's funny. In my family, I had the reputation where they wouldn't even let me drink coffee. In my family, because I'm so crazy when I'm very sensitive to it.
I've been to Spain, I've been to the Middle East, where some of these cultures will drink very strong coffee at 10 o'clock at night and then go straight home to bed and not have a difficulty sleeping, or at least not report it. And is it true that caffeine affects, is it possible that there's a cultural difference if you're tolerant of caffeine that you can sleep easier after drinking it? I mean, I just can't explain that.
Yeah. So, I mean, two things. One is, again, the more caffeine you drink, we all develop partial tolerance. So it's possible these people have developed the tolerance. But I think really a lot of it has to do with this genetic variability I mentioned earlier. And I don't know if that would be cultural, you know, if some societies are less or more tolerant. But, I mean, I think we all know people like this who can, you know, have a big cup of coffee right after dinner and then trundle off to bed and sleep like a baby.
I hate those people.
Yeah, for most of us, that's not the case. Well, and on the other end, of course, there are people who are really keenly caffeine sensitive, and I think those of us who drink coffee regularly, and this was an eye-opener as I researched the book, I used to sort of discount the people who said when they had a cup of decaf, they'd say they're completely wired. But really, you know, 12 milligrams of caffeine, the amount in, say, a, you know, 16-ounce Starbucks decaf, for some people, that will really be enough to get them quite wired.
So Murray, one of the things I know when in reading your book, it's a, you know, talk about how it's so many different cultures have it, caffeine, and we treat it like innocuous. It's innocuous. Is it? It can't possibly be innocuous for everybody.
No, and it's not for everybody. And I think most of us clearly tolerate it quite well. But again, for some people, it can be a real problem, and the issues we talked about earlier are the big ones, anxiety and insomnia. And, you know, it's interesting because these are certainly two of the most widespread problems that people face in modern society.
Oh. I think I just got it. So we all drink caffeine, and then, yeah. And one of the things I was reading is like 80% of women of a certain age complain that they can't sleep.
Yeah, right.
And so maybe there's a relationship.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. I think it would be very much overstating the case to suggest that everybody who drinks coffee or takes caffeine daily and has trouble sleeping would be relieved of that problem by quitting. But I am struck by how many people, and this is entirely anecdotal, how many people I've talked to who use caffeine daily, have trouble sleeping, but have never, you know, moderated or eliminated caffeine from the diet just to see if it helps.
Yeah.
You know, for some people, it's going to help.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I also know you were talking about is like the variability in, you know, a cup of coffee has how much in general?
Well, typically about 15 to 20 milligrams per ounce. So, you know, and this is the problem. When we talk about a cup of coffee, it's a problem with size. But say, you know, a cup of a 16-ounce cup of Dunkin' Donuts might put you in the range of, you know, 200, 250 milligrams.
Now, some of these energy drinks that are marketed have 320 milligrams for 16 fluid ounces.
Most are significantly less. The Monsters and the Rock Stars you see are typically about 160 milligrams, and a Red Bull, you know, the standard can is about 80. So most of the energy drinks are not as caffeinated as the coffee we drink.
But, I mean, why don't, you mention in your book that they don't have to list the amount of caffeine in a beverage.
Which is crazy, yeah.
Why is it unregulated?
Well, FDA has really been playing catch up with the energy drink industry, and it's sort of pointing out some problems with caffeine regulation in general. You know, FDA, the energy drinks just sort of snuck onto the market without FDA ever giving them explicit approval to be marketed. Red Bull came onto the market, and then these other imitators and successors followed. And so FDA has never really established any standards for what energy drinks should do, including how they should be labeled. Now, many of them are starting to label voluntarily the amount of caffeine that they have.
Well, don't you think in some ways that might be a bit of a sales thing? Oh, they only have 250. We have 320.
It could be, yeah. But I also think it's sort of the least the basic information that any of us need to be informed consumers, you know, is to know what the, you know, if we're ingesting a caffeinated product, and they can tell easily how much caffeine is in it. We should be able to tell that right from the label.
What effect does caffeine have on early adolescent and
kids.
Adolescent kids? I mean, what happens to them? Is it different than the mechanism that happens with adults?
Well, the short answer is we need a lot more research here.
Okay.
The longer answer is we know that children and adolescents, most of them, take caffeine. And a recent study in pediatrics showed that 12 to 16-year-olds are taking 63 milligrams a day on average. So some are taking a lot more, clearly. And
wow.
Yeah, and since the dose is weight-dependent, this is another thing I think people miss a lot, is for, you know, I weigh 180 pounds. If a 90-pound kid is drinking a Diet Coke after dinner, most of us don't think he's getting a whopping dose of caffeine. But that would be the same as me drinking a Red Bull after dinner, which I wouldn't do.
Wow.
So I think we all need to pay, you know, closer attention to the doses of caffeine that not only we're taking, but particularly children and adolescents. Because, you know, if nothing else, they might suffer some of the symptoms of sleeplessness and anxiety.
We also, there was the alcohol, you know, the people have the Red Bull and the vodka,
yeah,
or the Four Loko, and we've Loko, heard stories, right, of people having, you know, psychoses or just complete early, like very quick blackouts due to that combination of alcohol and caffeine. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really interesting thing that was sort of an indication of how FDA can regulate these things. Four Loko was basically a blend of alcohol and caffeine that had a pretty good dose of caffeine per, you know, can. And what was happening was people were drinking these, sort of binge drinking. And my understanding is basically, you know, people often think of caffeine as sobering up an alcoholic, which it doesn't do. It gives an alcoholic more energy than they would either have.
That's all they need.
Yeah.
And, right. And so what was happening is people were able to get drunk and then do silly things when they were, you know.
For longer.
Yeah, for longer. Exactly. And so, but what FDA said to the bottlers of Four Loko and other such products is basically, if you can't provide the science to show that these products are safe, we're going to ask you to pull them off the shelves. They didn't provide the science, and they did pull them off the shelves, and this is what they could also do with energy drinks if FDA, you know, determines that they're a problem.
Well, one of the things you also said in the book was that we consume less caffeine than, like, the generation before that, us.
That seems...
I can't believe that with all those little coffee shops around. And when I go to Starbucks, my tea bag at Starbucks is about 8 times the size of a normal tea bag.
It's counterintuitive. The reason for this is that we 2/3 of our caffeine still comes from coffee in our diet. So despite the proliferation of, you know, caffeinated soft drinks, et cetera, we coffee is still the big one. And coffee consumption peaked in this country around 1950, and we were drinking nearly twice as much coffee as we are today. Yeah, so it was. I think it's safe to say that there was a more caffeinated generation than we are now.
It's not what I picture, but
it's not. And I think part of it is our caffeine consumption is sort of more conspicuous now. In those days, there was just a pot of coffee always going in every kitchen, in every break room, in every office, just all the time, and it was just, you know, it was just sort of a part of the daily routine.
Right, and it was at the end of the day often. I remember my parents, like, you guys go, you know, we're going to have our cup of coffee.
And this is another interesting thing about that. There was an association, I don't know if you noticed this in your parents' house, but a lot of people, an association between coffee drinking and cigarette smoking.
Yes.
Well, smokers metabolize caffeine twice as quickly as non-smokers. They actually produce more of the primary enzyme that breaks caffeine down into its metabolites.
Oh, so if you smoke, you can sleep.
If you smoke and you drink a cup of coffee, it might help you sleep better.
Oh, God.
that's the takeaway. We're telling people.
No.
Now, in the book, you also talk about some of the beneficial effects of moderate caffeine use. Can you talk about that with us?
Yeah, so a couple of them. I think one that is not surprising to athletes is that caffeine is, you know, can give you a boost for athletic events. What I was surprised to find is it's more significant of a boost than you would expect. So, say in a 1-hour foot race, a moderate dose of caffeine, again, not much more than a daily dose of coffee would give you, will give you a 1-3% increase over in time, a 1-3% improvement in time over non-caffeinated athletes.
Is there
that surprised me?
Is it banned in any sports?
Well, the NCAA still has a limit, an upper limit for caffeine, but the trend has been towards less regulation and not more. And it's because of what I just mentioned is the dose that tends to be most effective for athletes is right, you know, not much higher than the dose that we tend to take daily just in coffee. So the challenges to regulating it would be, you know, really tough.
Yeah.
Well, this is a great subject, and I
everybody read this book. It's just amazing.
So Murray Carpenter is the author of Caffeinated: How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us, and Murray will be speaking about his new book Monday, March 24th at 7 p.m. at the Trident Booksellers, 338 Newbury Street in Boston. Great bookstore, by the way. Thank you so much for being on Right Turn Radio, Murray. We're going to come back. You're listening to Right Turn Radio, but we'll be back right after the break. Abby, stimulants.
Let's take it a little higher.
Let's go up the scale now. It's a very stimulating conversation.
Being with you is always stimulating.
Oh well, we have this thing going on in the United States where we have a jump in the number of prescriptions of ADHD medication, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder medication. The number of young Americans taking medications for ADHD nearly doubled from 2008 to 2012. That's kind of a stunning number to me. Express Scripts, it's an independent coalition, reported that the number of American adults receiving prescriptions had risen for ADHD medications had risen 53% to an estimated 2.6 million people in 2012 from 1.7 million in 2008.
And the use among adults ages 26 to 34 has almost doubled. I mean, even more so.
So our guest in the studio right now is Dr. Himal Mitra, who's a staff psychiatrist at the Brookline Center as well as at Right Turn. He also has a private practice. Welcome to Right Turn Radio, Dr. Mitra.
Thank you.
So, you know, I know this is the question we all want to know, and you don't have the answer, but, what is ADHD, and why are stimulants prescribed for it?
Well, ADHD is a condition in which there are lots of different criteria that we can talk about, but there are two versions. There's the inattentive version, and it really is a problem, at least it was originally defined as a problem, with paying attention in a focused way over time. The H part is hyperactivity, so that in addition to inattention, there's also a kind of physical excitability or activity that can get in the way in other ways. So in a sense, if you think about your fourth grade class, you have the daydreamers and the troublemakers.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two varieties, let us say, of ADD, of attention deficit disorder. And stimulants have proven to be an extraordinarily useful way to treat it. The stimulants mean one group called the amphetamines, which is what everybody thinks of as speed, which comes in a variety of versions. And then there's methylphenidate, which is the other stimulant generally used.
That's Ritalin.
It's also called Ritalin or Concerta in long-acting versions.
Mm-hmm. And the other one, an amphetamine example, would be Adderall.
Exactly.
Okay. What's the difference between ADD and ADHD? Because everybody goes, oh, I can't, I'm so, you know, I can't pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, I'm ADD. My doctor told me I'm ADD. What does that mean?
Well, attention deficit disorder is really a condition that starts in childhood and in maybe half the cases can extend into adulthood as well. Although authorities differ on whether it's really only half or whether it's just that you find new ways to compensate as you get older. But the fact that somebody does not pay attention or is having trouble paying attention doesn't necessarily mean that they have attention deficit disorder, because there are lots of psychological conditions that can get in the way of attention. For instance, depressed people don't pay attention very well.
Worried people,
people under stress, people who are not getting enough sleep, people who are manic don't pay attention in an entirely different way. But these are all, there are all kinds of things that can lead to attention problems. If there isn't a long history that's consistent over years and years and years, it shouldn't really be called attention deficit disorder.
Why, in your opinion, has there been such an uptick in the number of prescriptions written in recently?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. I suspect that attention deficit disorder is actually, you know, that a good many people who wouldn't have reached treatment are now being treated. But I also suspect that it's gotten to be a bit easier to write prescriptions. I'm not sure that all of those prescriptions written are necessarily appropriate.
So people come in and say, hi, doc, I'm having trouble studying. Every time I go to sit down and study, I mean, this starts out a lot of times as a study aid. Many of these stimulants, the Adderall, Ritalin, et cetera, people use it to focus.
Yes.
And it would work. And it's kind of passed around. But then what happens is they go in and they find they like this. And, I mean, I've heard stories in my career of people who kind of go in and kind of know what to say.
Yes,
but,
that's
but
right.
But you're feeling like a good history would make a big difference, because if...
Absolutely. Yes, I think that a careful, thorough history that includes, you know, looking for other conditions as well that may interfere with attention is crucial. And, as I say, a history that includes a fairly clear sense of what they were like as children is very, very important.
But there seems to be... And what we see at the clinic sometimes is this disconnect. You hear these stories of, you know, I originally went in, I told them, you know, just kind of, you know, these stories, I can't study, I'm not able to pay attention, my mind races, and they're written a prescription. It doesn't seem like every doctor is as thorough getting the history. And there's a disconnect in the prescribing in the medical community with many of these doctors. I mean, it seems to me that this condition's obviously existed for a long time, but, you know, a 50% increase in prescriptions written speaks to that. What can you put into context why that would happen among so many doctors?
Well, I think in
speaking,
some ways...
Speaking to condemn your field, yes.
Yes,
could you alienate yourself?
I expect to be lynched afterwards. They're going to burn a caduceus in my lawn after. But I think that it's gotten easier. I mean, I think that there are a lot of pressures on medical sort of practice.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, it's gotten easier just to write a prescription. I mean, I think this is true in all fields of medicine. But as I said before, I also suspect that a good many people who really did have attention deficit disorder were not actually getting treated for it.
So why are stimulants so popular? Why do people want to take them?
Because they make you feel great. They make you feel as if your mind is working at 180%. They keep you going for a long time. They can help you focus on, you know, tasks that require lots of attention over a very long stretch of time. Anyone, even people with no sense of an attention problem, will respond to a stimulant. That's why they're so popular around exam times.
Are there dangers for using stimulants for a long time or overusing them?
Absolutely. I mean, stimulants work by, they increase dopamine transmission in certain specific pathways of the brain. And as a result, they can also lead to psychotic symptoms.
You mean
and
like,
they can certainly lead to sleep problems and the like. And additionally, they are addictive, as many dopamine-active drugs are.
And so paranoia is one of the things. We were reading an article about a young man who got increasingly paranoid. And that's one of those things that was one of the first symptoms that he was showing. And it was like, you know, it was so sad to watch. And anybody I know who's been through this has talked about it, that feeling like everybody knows that I'm doing this thing, so I can't go out. You know, it's one of the kind of fairly universal thing that people run into.
And is it, you know, we speak to people sometimes who are became cocaine abusers and addicts, and they say, you know, when this normal quote-unquote person takes cocaine, they get hyperactive and, you know, very attentive.
Yes.
A lot of people that come in to see us talk about getting calmed. It's the only time they feel calm.
Right. My house was never as clean.
Right.
I could focus.
Right. And they're focused and they're even relaxed. That's called a paradoxical effect. Is that true? Or?
Well, you know, I think in a sense that's right, because what it does is allow people who have this kind of scattering, this constant propensity to scatter their attention, to bring all those things back in so that they can go on doing one thing at length. And they can stop doing them and focus on something else when they need to. Whereas in untreated ADHD or ADD, people are either completely scattered or sometimes as a compensation, they learn how to hyperfocus. So,
what's hyperfocus mean?
Hyperfocus means that it is very difficult for them to change what they're doing at this moment.
You mean suppose they're reading a book, you may have a real hard time getting them out of a book.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so this same action happens with the prescription medications.
I'm sorry.
As
with the cocaine, is that the same action in the brain that
yes,
works?
Yes, I mean, it's actually very interesting. I mean, there are people who, with whom I've been able to diagnose, well, if people have a history of using drugs, as an awful lot of people do, I may ask them what drugs they really preferred. And sometimes they say things like, well, you know, the first time I ever tried speed, it helped me feel like things were normal, like I could pay attention, like, you know, I wasn't constantly feeling anxious or, you know, like I was missing something or not getting something done. And I always find that an extraordinarily compelling story for ADD.
Why is the action different on different people? I mean, I know that's a huge question, but...
Tell us about physiology.
But I mean, why does that affect... If I have too much coffee,
yes,
I will be completely unable to focus on anything, and I have anxiety, and I can't, you know...
Yes.
Why does it affect people differently? Is it just the wiring? Is it just the way the people are wired in the brain?
Well, I think that as with most psychological difficulties that end up being treatable with medication, there is some difficulty, some kind of problem in the way a particular set of pathways works. And that problem usually has to do with a particular set of neurotransmitters, which are the chemicals that are used to allow transmission to go from one nerve cell to another. And it's usually related to dopamine, and that's probably the case in most of these, most ADD. Although since we also have drugs that work for ADD that don't affect dopamine, it's obviously not the whole story.
I'm John Hogan here on Right Turn Radio. Not enough stimulants in you today, Abby. How about you?
No, I'm feeling a little... No, it's serious. I usually have a cup of coffee before the show, and I didn't tonight.
And how's that affecting you?
I'm not as smart as I usually am. No, I mean, and we, you know, we can joke about this because, you know, we are lucky because we aren't abusing these substances, right?
Right.
And one of the things I want to talk to Dr. Mitra about is, you know, the difference between use and abuse. Most people who use caffeine don't get in trouble with it. Some people do.
Right.
Most people who are prescribed medications, you know, for their ADD or just take it occasionally to study, which isn't how it's recommended to be used, don't get in trouble with it. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I do think that there is a difference between getting high, in a manner of speaking, and feeling normal or feeling calm or feeling focused. With ADD, a drug like this, if used correctly, is actually, in a sense, correcting a deficit. And therefore, it's helping people feel not high, but normal. But if they don't have ADD, or sometimes I suppose even if they do, there's a kind of liking or wanting it to make you feel high and taking sometimes more and more and more, which can lead you into real trouble. That's how people get addicted. I mean, there are a couple of things that predispose to addiction. One is that kind of sudden change in the way you feel. The other has to do with the steepness of the slope with which the drug enters the bloodstream and then leaves it. So that drugs like, to go to a different class, like Xanax, for instance, which goes in very quickly and comes out very quickly, are much more prone to produce addiction.
Well, so some of these have like, you know, they're in your system, they're out of your system.
That's right.
And some are now designed to be longer acting.
That's right, exactly. So in my practice, if somebody gives me a reasonable story for ADD, the first thing I usually do is to give them a 1 or 2 week trial of the immediate acting at the lowest dose to see if it actually makes a difference and what they're going to tell me about the difference it makes afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I generally switch them to a long-acting drug, which, you know, can go on for 8 to 12 hours and it's much less prone to get addicted to because it doesn't change the way you feel as suddenly as the immediate acting drug.
So you
does.
Don't get that feedback. You're not feeling like, oh, wow, this is great. You're feeling like, oh, maybe I am feeling a little different.
Now, I know some people are concerned in children and adolescents when they're prescribed these because are we, you know, if they do get that, you know, what we call the bump or whatever,
yes.
are we getting their brains used to that getting high, basically?
Well, I think that's a reasonable question. I think that's one of the reasons we have to be so very careful about making sure that people who are given AD or given stimulants to take really do have ADD,
mm-hmm.
and that the change that it produces in them is consistent with the way ADD responds to stimulants. That is, it's not just high, it's really a kind of calming or focusing capacity. You know, it's meant to help with other things too, like executive function, so that, you know, people who tend to procrastinate if they have ADD are maybe a little less prone to do so when they take stimulants. It also helps with emotional dysregulation, which is another typical issue in ADD, especially in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you see numbers like this, that in the over the course of 4 to 6 years, the amount of prescriptions almost doubled. Does that concern you?
Yes. Although, I mean, it concerns me from a public health standpoint, to be sure, because I don't really know that it's necessarily being prescribed by the kind of people who are taking care to really evaluate and to follow closely and to monitor. I mean, a lot of the stories of things going wrong have to do with physicians who didn't really pay attention to how many pills they were prescribing at a time and how often they were doing it.
Yeah.
And to a certain degree, we can now rely on, you know, pharmacies and insurance companies to kind of add a second or third layer of watch or monitoring on that. But even so, things do fall apart and people have to be careful. I mean, prescribers have to be careful.
In treating ADD and ADHD, we've been talking about stimulants. That's the topic of the show. But what alternatives are there in the treatment for those disorders?
Well, it's a very interesting question. I think that the people who develop drugs have been trying to find alternative ways of treating ADD that don't use stimulants. One example is Vyvanse, which is actually a drug that when metabolized in the stomach produces an amphetamine, but it can't be ground up and shot up, for example, because it doesn't work. It has no psychological activity that way. Vyvanse was originally touted as being less prone to produce addiction, and that may be true, although it certainly can do it. I mean, people can become addicted to Vyvanse. Other drugs may include things like modafinil, which actually was thought originally not to have anything to do with the dopamine system and therefore not to be addictive. It now turns out that it probably does have a certain amount of dopamine activity. And so in theory, one could get addicted to modafinil, which is called Provigil.
So there are other meds.
There are others.
But also, I'm wondering if there's behavior modification or if there's any stuff other than medications that, you know, people are being treated.
Oh, Absolutely. Although I would like to mention a couple of other drugs first. And they're important because they don't work on dopamine. One is guanfacine, which comes in the long-acting form called Intuniv. And the other is Strattera, which is generically called atomoxetine. Now, atomoxetine is probably not as effective in general, or isn't as effective for as many people as the stimulants are. But they both do not work on dopamine, and so clearly they are doing something different, and they're not addictive, either of them. Anyway.
So, I mean, I also think, I mean, the one thing that you didn't get to say yet was that people need to be in treatment.
Yes.
And in treatment, you know, you can learn behavior modification things. You can learn how to control some of the triggers. People have found that, like, meditation helps, yoga helps. Mm-hmm. The people I know who are in, lots of exercise helps.
Exercise. So, I mean, like, your theory about kids, you know, in previous generations, and actually most of human history, you know, talking about, like, a kid, you know, that was maybe hyperactive and attention deficit would go out and climb trees, and it would, you know, his kind of self-treatment would manifest itself in, like, a lot of physical activity.
Right. This is, some of these are just, you know, diagnostic because they're stuck in a classroom.
Right. And so that might be a reason.
And there are lots of alternative, I mean, not alternative, but additional things to get treated, you know.
I mean, it's almost as if there's a quantum of physical activity that kids may have to expend over the course of a day in order to be calm enough to do the other things that are necessary.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I wish they could get more.
Yeah. it's a different society now than when we grew up. We're, yes, you know, I don't want to sound like
anything.
When I was your age.
Well, I mean, come on, John. The hunter-gatherer days are long.
So I want to tell everybody that...
I want to say thank you to Dr. Himal Mitra for being on the show. Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.